formerly respectable or even eminent figures like John Mack, Roger Woolger, and Barbara Brennan, whose books I'd read, had succumbed to some form of dementia. The many people of apparent integrity who'd share stories with me of miraculous coincidences, inexplicable experiences, ghosts, and so on, were actually putting me on, trying to seem special, hungry for attention, and I must be a poor judge of character. My life is full of dupes, frauds, hoaxers, liars, and the mentally unstable. Even my own wife lies to me for no apparent reason about extraordinary experiences that happened to her years ago. If I try hard enough, I can cobble together a belief system in which none of these unscientific occurrences ever really happens. 2. These experiences that I've had, that I've been told, and that I've read about are as real as any other. The people in my life are generally as they seem, not pathologically plagued by confabulation, selective memory, and compulsive lying. John Mack did not write his books about alien abduction because being a Harvard professor of psychiatry wasn't good enough and he wanted fame and notoriety. Eminent scientists do not usually throw their careers down the sewer in some vain pursuit of purely imaginary psi phenomena. And in my own experiences, what I saw, and felt what I felt. And finally, believing all this, I must also believe that the entire corpus of science is fundamentally incomplete. Neither of these two interpretations suffers any internal logical inconsistency. Just like the shy girl, I can fit all the data into one of many interpretations, many universes. Even Occam's razor cannot always rescue me. It is usually simpler to discard inconvenient facts on some pretext. By choosing a truth, I am choosing what universe I will live in and making a statement to myself and the world about who I am. Sometimes I might even do this playfully in the spirit of exploration and discovery. Like when I spend my days immersing myself in skeptics' writings and notice how it changes my state of mind, emotions, and relationships. Usually, though, the progression from one belief state to another is unconscious, subject to a logic and a process beyond my understanding. A truth that served me well in one stage of existence becomes obsolete as I move on to another. And so it is with all of us. The work of Gödel and Turing has ended forever the Babelian program of taking nature by finite means. It has shown us the limits of reducing reality to label and number, and the impossibility of ever subjugating truth to certainty. Understood metaphorically, mathematical incompleteness hints at a new way of understanding truth, knowledge, and belief as a way of relating to the universe and defining who we are, a process of co-creation of reality, and not a mere unveiling and cataloging of what is already objectively out there. Certainty is gone, but in its place, we have freedom. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. Order without design. Certain theologians and scientists have made much of the amazing fact that the physical constants of the universe seem to be precisely calibrated to allow the existence of life. the value of the strong nuclear force, the fine structure constant, the gravitational constant, the mass of the electron, and so on would, if different by even a few percent, no longer allow the possibility of life or even, in some cases, stars or solid matter. Some cite this as evidence of a creator setting the stage for life. Others invoke a multiplicity of universes, each with different constants. To me, the most intriguing is the possibility that the constants actually co-vary with each other and are subject to feedback mechanisms that eventually brought them into the stable attractor configuration they occupy today. In any event, the universe's pregnancy with order, beauty, and life does not arise from this set of possibly arbitrary physical constants alone. Order and beauty are woven into the fabric of reality even more deeply than that. They emerge on every level, in every nonlinear system of sufficient complexity. We shall look at a few of these systems at different levels to get some sense of the ubiquity of order, order without design, in the continuing miracle in which we live. The metaphorical and practical implications of self-organization are staggering, perhaps even more so than those of quantum mechanics. I first became aware of self-organization 16 years ago when, just out of college, a friend handed me Order Out of Chaos by Ilya Prigogine and Isabel Stengers. This book blew my mind. Amid numerous examples of self-organization in chemical systems, the book gave me my first glimpse of the Mandelbrot set, an extraordinarily complicated fractal generated by an extremely simple recursive formula. To generate it, take a point C in the complex plane and apply the formulas ZO equals 0, ZN plus 1 equals ZN2 plus C. After a given number of iterations, the sequence of ZO, Z1 through ZN will either exceed absolute value 2, after which it quickly diverges toward infinity, or it will stay in the neighborhood of the origin. If C generates a sequence that stays tame and never diverges toward infinity, it is the Mandelbrot set. Unfortunately, there is no general finite way to decide whether that will happen, because even after a billion iterations, it could still start diverging on the billion and tenth. In mathematical language, the set is not recursively enumerable and therefore not decidable either. And this means that there is no shortcut or reason for the set to have the structure it does. No reason except that's the way it is. The only reason you can generally give why a point is in the set is simply to quote the definition. After n iterations, it has still not diverged. Our complete reductionistic description of the M set tells us nothing about it. In effect, here is a reality that cannot be reduced. We could say the same thing about any random set of points, but what makes the Mandelbrot set special, and a fecund source of metaphor, is that it is evidently not some disorderly scattering of points on the plane, but seems to possess order, structure, and even beauty. Yet a full finite description is impossible. Any such description leaves out an infinity of structure. Notice the parallel with the inescapable reduction of reality entailed in the representational language and measure described in Chapter 2. The M set is not unique in the spontaneous emergence of structure. The same thing has been discovered in other mathematical systems, such as cellular automata, neural networks, simulations of group behavior, and Boolean networks. Stuart Kaufman calls it order for free because it is not evident in the defining equations. Studying Boolean networks, Kaufman has even identified general parameter values that virtually ensure order will emerge, even though the only way to find out what the order looks like is to calculate it out. Let me offer one more example. The cellular automaton called Langdon's ant couldn't be any simpler. Imagine an ant crawling on a grid where each square must be either black or white. If the ant lands on a black square, he colors it white and turns right. If he lands on a white square, he colors it black and turns left. The ant wanders aimlessly about, patterning and repatterning the plane, until at some point, depending on the initial setup, something very strange happens. The ant begins building a highway out to infinity. Numerous computer trials confirm that this happens no matter what the initial setup. Yet this is an empirical fact only. It is probably impossible to prove it analytically. In other words, the only reason or explanation for why does an ant build a highway every time is because it is true for setup A, setup B, setup C, ... which is really no explanation at all. Such an explanation amounts to because it does. As with the M set, we have a complete reductionistic explanation of the ant's every move, yet it tells us nothing about the large-scale structure. In other words, nothing in the simple defining equations of Langdon's ant would indicate that highway-building behavior will result. There is no finite explanation, yet it happens just the same. There is no simpler why, it just is. Neither, therefore, can we be certain that highway building always happens. We could demonstrate it for a billion starting setups, but it could fail for the billion and first. Analogous situations are ubiquitous in the world of cellular automata and related fields, leading researchers such as Stephen Wolfram to advocate a new kind of science based on empirical discovery and not analytic proof. Since science is about understanding the world, what they are advocating is really a new conception of understanding, one which is no longer subject to certainty. It becomes necessary to accept that complex systems have emergent properties for which we will never find a reductionistic why. Not only certainty, but also predictability and control fall by the wayside. We must accept that no matter how precise our control over initial conditions, the results might surprise us. With Langdon's ant, we know highway building will result, but not when or where. Changing merely one square in the initial grid can utterly alter the when and where. In chaos theory, this is known as sensitive dependence on initial conditions, which afflicts not just mathematical systems, but physical, chemical, and biological systems as well. Anything with nonlinearity and feedback. We might empirically infer general information analogous to the ant's highway building, but the details will elude us. For example, we can look at Earth's meteorological data and predict that hurricanes will blow through the Caribbean and explain why, but we are helpless to predict their timing or precise paths. Despite vast improvements in data density, weather forecasting is still inaccurate beyond a few days. Exponential increases in data density bring at best linear improvements in forecast period. These examples show that determinism and practical predictability are actually two different things. idealized Newtonian two-body mechanics possesses both. Past, present, and future are contained in a single equation, and the evolution of a system at any point in time is easy to calculate. But with few exceptions, this only holds for linear systems. A free pendulum is infinitely predictable. A driven pendulum, where a motor drives the fulcrum back and forth, is chaotic. In a linear system, uncertainties in measurement result only in linear divergence in predicted results. Noise stays manageably small in comparison to signal. But in nonlinear systems, the noise quickly overwhelms the signal. A tiny difference in initial conditions results in totally different behavior. The word design implies an intentional awareness of end results that is built into the initial setup. The engineer desires a certain outcome and so builds that into his design. Design implies some kind of predictability, properties of the whole that can be predicted from the properties of the parts. When people speak of intelligent design as a cosmological theory, this is exactly what they have in mind. An external creator God who calibrated the initial conditions and laws of the universe in precisely the way that would result in intelligent life. I am suggesting a different conception of God, not as a creator, but as creativity itself, not outside the universe, but an inseparable property of the universe. Why should the M-set be so ornately beautiful? We hunger for a why, but there is none. No reason except that is the way it is. Reality is just like that. In the Mandelbrot set, I see God, a miraculous mystery that I can never fully grasp, not because of the limits of my mind, but because it is constitutionally ungraspable, impervious to reduction. There is nothing to understand, nothing to grasp. It is just like that. It is because it is. It is the eternal I am. Just as 2 plus 2 equals 4, the M set could be no other way. Order for free, beauty for free, not designed that way, but an irreducible property of reality. I wanted to say built in, but even that smuggles in a dualistic reduction of its self-sufficient miracle. It is ironic indeed that mathematics, which through its digits sought to manipulate, tame, and reorder nature, has brought us back to the indubitable realization that reality at its most fundamental level is forever beyond our grasp. And because this is not an oddity of abstract computational mathematics, but broadly true of any nonlinear system, the technological program of complete control can never come to pass. Time and time again, experience has shown us that however precise our measurement and control, the end results are unpredictable in a nonlinear system. The putative successes of the ascent of technology owe themselves to the linearity of machine technology. In linear systems, it works. The more precise the control of initial conditions, the more precisely predictable the end result. Our civilization has developed linear technology to its maximum. The more complex a machine becomes, the exponentially more relationships among its parts must be considered to keep it under control. Control thus comes at an escalating price, a price which in human terms is nothing less than the subjugation of life itself to its demands. The exponential conversion of all things to money described in Chapter 4 is just one aspect of this. Our present mode of technology only works when its objects are kept simple, linear, when variables are controlled or eliminated. We can control reality only through reducing it, reducing complex ecosystems to the managed forest, the monocultured farm, the suburban lawn, reducing complex chemistries in herbs and food to just so many active ingredients and vitamins, reducing the complexity of human social relationships to the orderliness of a planned society. Modern technological society is an example of a system possessing order and even hints of beauty without design. It is a brutal fact that all human attempts to design society from the top down, as opposed to letting it grow organically, have been abject failures. Witness the present contrast between North Korea and Cuba, both experiencing considerable isolation from the rest of the world. The former, a centralized command economy, is in dire straits, while the latter, though poor, gets by with an adequate quality of life thanks to the resilience springing from the high degree of local autonomy there. The complexity and scale of technological society defies human attempts at design. Any new technological invention, any new law or social innovation, has effects that ripple through the system in unpredictable ways. In a non-linear system, such as a society or an ecology, the effects of any technological fix are wholly unpredictable. Introduce a new species to control a pest, and the end result might be the emergence of an even worse pest. Elevate serotonin levels with a reuptake inhibitor, and the end result might be a reduction in the number of receptors for serotonin and other neurotransmitters, resulting in depression even worse than before. Build a new road to ease congestion, and new developments might end up making congestion all the worse. Cut down all the slow-growing trees and replace them with a fast-growing lumber crop, and diseases might sweep through this weakened ecosystem that result eventually in less lumber, not more. Introduce computers to reduce the drudgery of office work, and people end up spending more time at their desks than ever. Add nitrogen fertilizer to increase soil fertility, and the resulting changes in soil ecology end up reducing its fertility. All of these unpredictable and even contradictory results arise from non-linearity. We can pretend the world is linear and enforce our pretense to a certain extent, but only at increasing cost to freedom and life, because outside a very narrow realm, the world is not in fact linear. Our civilization is built on that tiny segment that is linear, or that can be reasonably viewed that way. Today that pretense is crumbling. The price has become unbearable. Yet, unbearable though it may be, we will continue to bear it as long as we are ignorant of any alternative. We will continue to remedy the failures of control with even more control, intensifying the plundering of earth, life, beauty, and health until all are utterly consumed. That is why it is so important to be aware of another way, suggested in part by the scientific developments I describe in this chapter. We are inclined to see the unintended consequences of technology as the result of lack of foresight, and to hope that better social engineering might solve the problem. In fact, the problem is insoluble. It is insoluble, that is, by the types of solutions we call design. Unable to conceive of other types of solutions, we desperately try harder until we succumb to despair. What other types of solutions might there be that are not designed? How about those that are allowed to grow? The technology flowing from that paradigm might be so different from what we have today as to be unrecognizable. Someday soon, when we fully digest the futility of control arising from the non-linearity of our universe, we will begin to adopt a wholly different approach to technology, one that does not attempt nature's reduction, but seeks rather its fulfillment. This is not simply a decision about the appropriateness of such and such a technology. It is the recognition that we are incompetent to determine its ultimate effects. Technological development will come from a place of humility. The technological program of complete control follows the scientific program of complete understanding in the Newtonian sense of reductionism and predictability. A new technology that is not of control depends, therefore, on a new mode of understanding. To understand something need not mean to have taken its measure, to know its inner workings, to reduce it analytically. We have now seen the limits of this mode of understanding in physics and mathematics. The next two sections will reveal identical limits in biology and ecology. Some things, perhaps most things, can be understood only as wholes and through their interaction with the rest of the world. Such understanding comes through relationship and experience, even, we could say, through intimacy. No longer can we expect science to make us lords and possessors of nature. Instead, we will see its purpose as being to bring us into more intimate relationship to nature. The spirit of discovery, curiosity, and wonder that is the deepest motivation for science will remain intact. In the absence of certainty, reason will lose its primacy as the royal road to truth and resume its rightful place as one of several modes of knowledge, each suited to its proper domain. Returning to the alchemical model of Chapter 3, it is the function of the head to reflect, of the heart to know, and of the viscera to transform. The first is cool, the second warm, the third hot. The head, cool reason, cold hard science has its place. The problem today is that it has usurped the functions of the others. We have built a civilization in which we look to reason, to science, to specialists of all stripes, to guide our society and create our future. We have given them a task for which they are constitutionally incapable. Analysis and reason cannot know. They can explore, break apart, reflect, but it is not theirs to know or to choose. They cannot apprehend all the qualities listed in Chapter 3, spirit, beauty, life, consciousness, meaning, purpose, love, that when you take it apart are not there. As a result, all of them are notoriously absent from cold hard science, which, following Galileo's lead, concerns itself only with the measurable, that which can be reduced to number. Another way of putting it is that science and reason are blind. Without the heart's guidance, their methods are equally capable of good and of evil. Remember that the Holocaust was conducted according to a terrible logic with the utmost rational efficiency. According to a particular choice of first principles, the whole thing was perfectly reasonable. Similarly, enormous scientific and engineering efforts today go forward with the manufacture of armaments, harmful chemicals, trashy consumer goods, and all the other instruments of planetary despoilation and cultural impoverishment, again, all in accordance with an implacable economic logic. Reason cannot evaluate truth. Reason cannot apprehend beauty. Reason knows nothing of love. Living from the head brings us to the same place, whether as individuals or as a society. It brings us to a multiplicity of crises. The head tries to manage them through more of the same methods of control, and the crises eventually intensify. Eventually, they become unmanageable, and the illusion of control becomes transparent. The head surrenders, and the heart can take over once again. We are now very close to this point. Reason can know nothing of beauty, truth, and love, but it can be put in their service. Reductionistic techniques cannot apprehend the emergent phenomena of wholes, but they can be tools for exploring them. Can you imagine a science dedicated to discovering humanity's role and function in the vast cosmic whole of which we are a part? Can you imagine a technology dedicated to the fulfillment of that role? Perhaps that is humanity's destiny. Not lordship over the cosmos, nor meaningless life and death in an indifferent, purposeless universe, but conscious participation in a cosmic evolutionary process whose grandeur we can only now begin to imagine. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. The nature of purpose. The absolute inherent limits of reductionistic logic, both as a means of understanding and as a road to control, invite us into a new mode of relationship with nature. Rather than attempting to explain the workings of the whole according to the workings of the parts, emergent phenomena demand that we sometimes must explain the workings of the parts according to the purpose of the whole. Instead of looking for the underlying causes or reasons for things, this mode of relationship looks for the purpose of things. The word for this type of understanding is teleology, which is a kind of causality that pulls events toward a future purpose. These two levels of explanation are complementary, not contradictory. Here is an example, courtesy of Stuart Kaufman. Imagine a bacteria swimming up a glucose gradient toward a food source. A reductionistic understanding would ask, what is really making it move in that direction? And would answer that question by observing how the glucose receptors work, what protein messengers they trigger, how those in turn trigger deformation of the cell membrane to generate movement, and so on. A teleological approach would understand the same molecular level phenomena from the opposite direction. They are happening in order that the bacteria can move toward food. Reductionism essentially asks what makes it do that, while teleology asks why does it do that. As is obvious from this phrasing, reductionism lends itself naturally to the mentality of engineering and control, making matter behave in a certain way, while teleological questioning assumes a purpose awaiting discovery, and would therefore foster caution and respect. Ideology aside, scientists use teleological thinking quite routinely. When we think in terms of empty niches attracting species to fill them, that is teleological reasoning, even if we add reductionistic mechanisms to explain how this occurs. Similar teleological reasoning informs our explanations of why birds fly south in the winter, why salmon swim upstream during spawning season, and why bears hibernate in the winter. In the history of technology, too, we can see teleology in action. Engineers develop components in order to meet a need in a larger whole. In fact, many components came into existence only after the larger whole was already there. The bicycle derailleur, for example. Why was it invented? I suppose you could answer that reductionistically, but the clearest answer is so that bicycles could shift gears. To say that this isn't the real reason is mere dogma. Reductionism and teleology are two lenses through which to view the same reality. For many phenomena, understanding comes only through teleological explanation. What is its purpose? Even when a reductionist explanation is possible, and in nonlinear systems, it often is not. Why then do we so emphasize the reductionistic explanation? Why do we arbitrarily declare that those properties that we can reduce, abstract, and measure to be more real than those that are emergent properties of wholes? One reason is that teleological understanding brings neither absolute certainty nor control. We often understand what something does without knowing how it works, but only knowing how it works can we eventually replace it with an artificial substitute. We might observe that garlic has antifungal properties. We then figure out a reductionistic why, an active component. Then we can isolate it and perhaps even synthesize it, no longer even needing garlic. We observe that apples taste good. when chemists isolate the flavor factors. We can reproduce the flavor of an apple without the need for apples. In this way, we transcend nature and fulfill the technological program. We observe that soil fertility depends on bacteria. If we knew exactly why, then we could perhaps eliminate the bacteria by implementing their function through technical means. We observe that forest health depends on the presence of top predators. If we can reduce them to a precise description of their functions, deer kill, distribution, and so on, we can replicate those functions and we won't need the predators anymore. The ultimate fulfillment of this ideology would be to replace every natural function in a wholly artificial reality, the totalization of the separate human realm. A teleological explanation does not give us this power. When we see the logic of the whole guiding the evolution of the parts, then we must recognize that each part of a body, an ecosystem, the biosphere, has a purpose that we may not ever fully understand, not even if we measure its every component. With awareness of a purpose to all things, no longer will we so cavalierly try to improve on nature. Lack of purpose, on the other hand, makes us the masters of the universe. There is no higher plan in which we might interfere, no natural order which we might disrupt. Today we are discovering such hubris to be sorely misguided. The pieces of nature or the body we once thought useless or redundant actually have unsuspected functions in maintaining the health and integrity of the whole. Our, quote, improvements come with hidden costs, stemming from these unseen functions that we scramble to cover with yet more improvements. From a teleological perspective, the failure of the technological fix and the program of control is inevitable. The teleological question, what is it for, is inherently respectful, both toward the subject of that question and toward the universe that embeds and purposes that subject. It makes of it more than just a thing, and of the world more than just a collection of things. What is it for? Invests the objects and processes of the world with individuality, selfhood, uniqueness, life, something beyond their descriptions as standardizable, generic building blocks. What is it for? Changes the world from an it into a you. The consequences of applying what is it for to other people in society are equally profound. It subverts the machine agenda of rendering human beings into standardized, replaceable parts. It resists the conversion of the social capital of unique local relationships and traditions into generic money. It confounds the social engineer's dream of molding human beings like so many building blocks to construct the perfect society. People are not human resources, nor are they assets. The world and everything in it is not a pile of instrumental stuff put here for my use. It has a purpose already. An organic necessity. On a personal level, teleology fosters respect. In contrast to the world of the selfish gene, wherein each survival machine manipulates competing survival machines to maximize its own benefit, in contrast to the economic view that analyzes relationships according to transactional models of loss and gain, what's in it for me? We see other people as, again, yous and not its, possessing their own purpose and destiny. We see them as other selves, not resources to manipulate. We no longer try to resist and control reality, but to align ourselves with the indwelling purpose that can only be discovered through relationship. We seek to know people and not to use them. As for others, so for oneself. It is teleology that inspires the eternal human question, why am I here? The science we have inherited provides no answer and is incapable of providing one. Any explanation couched in terms of genetics and human origins is a non-answer. In fact, it is an anti-answer. You are here because your ancestors survived, and no further answer is possible because there is no purpose, only causes. Thankfully, that emptying ideology is crumbling. I just wrote, "We seek to know people and not to use them." Applying that to oneself, we seek through self-knowledge to learn our purpose instead of exploiting our gifts for the temporary aggrandizement of an illusory separate self. To even believe such a purpose exists or could exist, to even believe that why am I here has an answer, already empowers life. It generates an urgency to discover what that purpose is. It makes any other life intolerable, including the standardized, compressed life offered by the machine. Self-respect demands that we live in accordance with our purpose and seek to fulfill it. We are not just here, we are here for a reason. I don't think I've ever penned a more banal spiritual cliche, but it is true nonetheless. Can you feel that in your bones? Young people know it most certainly. We call that knowledge idealism. They know that there is a way the world is supposed to be and a magnificent role for themselves in that more beautiful world. Broken to the lesser lives we offer them, they react with hostility, rage, cynicism, depression, escapism, or self-destruction, all the defining qualities of modern adolescence. Then we blame them for not bringing these qualities under control. And when they have finally given up their idealism, we call them mature. Having given up their idealism, they can get on with the business of survival. Practicality and security, comfort and safety, which is what we are left with in the absence of purpose. So we suggest they major in something practical, stay out of trouble, don't take risks, build a resume. We think we are practical and wise in the ways of the world. Really, we are just broken and afraid. We are afraid on their behalf, and less nobly, we are afraid of what their idealism shows us, the plunder and betrayal of our own youthful possibilities. The recovery of purpose, the acceptance of teleology into the language of science, promises whether directly or metaphorically to undo all of that. Unfortunately, teleology is still anathema to most scientists, to whom it is tantamount to magic and superstition. Yes, they might agree, we can provisionally say the bacteria wants to move toward food, but we actually know that what wants really mean is a set of biochemical states. The primary reality is at the molecular level. The teleological explanation is not the real explanation, just a heuristic convenience. I have already explained in this chapter why this view is no longer tenable. Ironically, though, it is perfectly consistent with the very religious views that science spurns, for both agree that purpose is not an intrinsic, real property of matter. James Lovelock, co-originator of the Gaia theory, has gone to great lengths to shake off the teleology epithet that critics apply to his theory. One of Lovelock's observations in support of Gaia is that Earth has maintained a roughly constant surface temperature for over 3 billion years, even as incoming solar energy has increased by some 30 or 40%. Similarly, Earth maintains fairly constant levels of oxygen in the atmosphere and salt in the oceans. All of life and inorganic processes, too, contribute to this homeostasis. According to the reductionistic paradigm, this is something of a coincidence. After all, there is no annual committee meeting to decide what each species and ecosystem must do this year to make everything work out. There is no board of directors, no supernatural force coordinating it all. Lovelock's response was Daisy World, a simplified computer model of temperature homeostasis in which rising temperatures cause white flowers to cover the planet and reflect more radiation to cool it, while falling temperatures support dark flowers that absorb radiation and warm the planet. See, he said, no coordinator is necessary. But has Lovelock really escaped teleology? Yes, he has escaped the necessity of an external coordinating force. But only in our dualistic mindset does this equate to teleology. For in fact, Lovelock's critics are right. The model of understanding that Gaia theory provides is teleological, because it invites us to understand life processes in terms of their purpose, not their cause. Why do algae emit dimethyl sulfide gas as a circumstantial byproduct of their metabolism, or in order to seed rain clouds? Why do bacteria on legume nodules fix nitrogen? Because ammonia happens to be a waste product of their ATV conversion pathway, or in order to allow plants to grow? Why do other bacteria accelerate rock weathering? Because they need the minerals to survive, or in order to speed the removal of carbon from the atmosphere? The first answer to each of these questions is not invalid, but it provides a limited understanding. Does random chance explain our great good fortune that all of Gaia's essential functions have been filled? Are we just lucky that aerobic bacteria arose just in time to rescue life on Earth from poisoning itself on oxygen? Do we owe our very existence to an absurdly unlikely series of chance events, one after another? If so, we are surely alone in the universe, poised always on the edge of oblivion should our run of luck end, hence the necessity of mastering nature. The mentality of control draws intimately from a fundamental scientific worldview that denies purpose. Until that changes, the regime of control will persist and continue to proceed toward totality. The random indifferent universe of our ideology invites, nay, demands control, and always is our position a precarious one, an anxiety woven into the fabric of life. That is why the gathering sea change in science is so significant. It is more than a mere shift of opinion. It portends a new relationship to the world and a new state of human beingness. When you read the words, does random chance explain, are we just lucky that, an absurdly unlikely series of chance events, did you expect I was about to trot out God as the alternative? Theologians have long cited the uncanny coordination of nature as evidence of God, noting as I have the hubris, despair, and license to plunder implicit in a mechanistic worldview. See what happens when you don't believe in God, they ask. Viewing the world of matter and the life of the flesh as devoid of sacredness, religious believers invoke an external God to invest life with meaning. Similarly, unaware that order and beauty can arise spontaneously, they invoke God the Creator or God the Intelligent Designer to infuse this universe of inert, randomly interacting matter with organization, beauty, and life. For a long time, we have seen their external supernatural God as the only alternative to an indifferent, mechanical, purposeless universe. No longer. The spontaneous emergence of organization in mathematical, chemical, and biological systems offers a third alternative. What if the coordination, purpose, and beauty we observe are inseparable from the properties of matter? What if divinity is an organic property of reality? So steeped are we in a dualistic mindset that we can hardly conceive of a purpose to nature except as externally defined by a supernatural intentional force, namely God. External to matter, such a God is by definition outside the subject area of science. Remember, though, that the whole conception of God as a force above and apart from nature is only as old as agriculture, reflecting the other dualistic separations that gained momentum in that time. Yet human intuitions of a meaning or significance to life surely predate agriculture with its supernal God, indicating that an external imposer of meaning, an external designer of purpose, is necessary only to the dualistic mind. The fundamentalist movement, along with most of the New Age, as well as transplanted spirituality from the East, is in part a response to the loss of sacredness that science seems to imply, and in part a reaction to the moral and social fragmentation that shares a common root with science in the age of separation. Agreeing with science that the ordinary world of matter is devoid of sacredness, they imagine a spiritual realm apart from the world, or in the case of Eastern transplants, retreat inward to the depths of the mind, ritual, yoga, and other spiritual practice. Religion thereby abets the mechanistic assumption of science. The world of matter is just matter, seen in this light. The doctrine of intelligent design, intended to bring God back into science, actually ends up confirming the soullessness of the physical world, the world of life and human life. Scientists typically cringe at any mention of an intention or purpose to evolution, tenaciously defending the Darwinian dogma that evolution arises solely from random variation and selection based on survival and replication. Alternative theories of biogenesis and evolution subvert deep-seated cultural assumptions of self and world, thus offending our intuitions. On a more superficial level, scientists' antipathy toward dissenting theories stems from their common association with the anti-scientific attacks of various proponents of creationism. Therefore, before I draw out the cultural and spiritual implications of some alternatives to Darwinism, I want to make clear right now, doubtless eliciting a sigh of relief from the scientific reader, that I am not going to espouse any form of creationism or intelligent design, ID, in this book. I sympathize with the motivation of the proponents of ID and creationism, however, and my sympathy is not of the patronizing variety which imputes to them a childish refusal to accept the obvious facts of the universe. No, their ultimate motivation is a sincere protest against a world that has been shorn of sacredness and purpose. They intuit that sacredness and purpose are real properties of the universe and not human projections, not the superstitious, wishful thinking of people unable to cope with the universe that, to quote Richard Dawkins again, has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Unfortunately, the proponents of ID are themselves subject to most of the same deeper hidden assumptions about the nature of reality that grip the scientific mainstream. This is no wonder, for these assumptions are written into the very culture we live in, into the conceptual vocabulary we use to describe the world, into the very structure of modern thought and language. The proponents of intelligent design are unwittingly replacing a greater miracle with a lesser miracle, a greater God with a lesser God, a greater mystery with a lesser mystery. They are also, again unwittingly, contributing to the very desacralization of the universe that is so unsettling about the scientific cosmology that dominates today. Their opposition to the atheistic cosmology, genesis, and evolution that is today's orthodoxy is actually a superficial opposition. On a deeper level, proponents of intelligent design exacerbate the very dualism that has robbed the modern world of sacredness and meaning. The typical ID argument first cites some of the well-known and very real difficulties of the neo-Darwinian orthodoxy. Then, citing the wild improbability of sophisticated structures such as the eye or the cellular metabolism having ever developed by chance, it goes on to conclude that such structures must therefore have been planned out and guided by a suprahuman intelligence, something as complex, as tightly coordinated, as miraculous as a living being, could never have emerged spontaneously. Therefore, it must have been consciously designed. But the very concept of design already smuggles in Newtonian concepts of reductionism, dualism, and mechanism. How do we go about designing something? Through a reductionistic process of assembling components, each of which themselves may also require designing. Design is hierarchical and modular. A problem is broken up into manageable pieces arranged by an outside intelligence. Spontaneous processes of growth are not considered design. Organisms do not design themselves, nor do parents design their children. Trapped in a dualistic mindset, we are hard-pressed indeed to see how complex, highly ordered, tightly coupled systems could have come about by themselves without external guidance. Our logic tells us that if it is purposeful, it must have been designed with a purpose. We cannot conceive of a purpose without a purposer, a design without a designer, beauty without an artist, because that has been our relationship to the world ever since agriculture supplanted the spontaneous goodness of nature with the imposed goodness of cultivation. In the mindset of agriculture, goodness comes forth only with work. Else the field runs to weeds and the livestock goes feral. The logic that inspires intelligent design is also the logic of engineering and control. It is the logic that defines the technological program whose failure is increasingly evident. To me, it is a far greater miracle that reality has the property of self-organization. Why should it? Why should reality not be boringly linear instead? Intelligent design carries a deep, hidden assumption that the universe is not inherently beautiful, alive, inspirited, but that it had to be made that way by an outside deity. The universe is just dead matter until God makes something of it. Life could only have sprung from the primordial soup if God had made it happen. The cell, the organ, the organism, the ecosystem could not work so perfectly by themselves. Matter has not that property. Intelligent design posits a universe that is less spiritual and not more. The mother of all religions, animism, had no such dualism in it. Animism, often misunderstood as the belief that all things are possessed of spirit, actually holds that all things are spirit. It holds that all things are sacred in themselves and not conditionally sacred because of something they may and by implication may not possess. One of the goals of this chapter is to translate animism into the language of modern science. And I've been reading from The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of Crises that is Birthing the Transition by Charles Eisenstein, published in 2006. I'm reading in Chapter 6, The Crumbling of Certainty, and we'll continue with that chapter next week. In the meantime, you need not wait. You may continue reading yourself on the web at Ascent www.theoriesofhumanity.com. And you can download this program as an MP3, as well as all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests at unwelcomeguests.org. Thank you so much for listening.